listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and, well, a lot of stuff going on. I do want to talk about the suicide of Robin Williams at some point today. And I don't know if Brian Fisher has an opinion on this or not, but I do. And I'd like to get into that. Joe Madison is going to drop by in the second hour of our program. We're going to talk about Michael Brown and, you know, what's going on across America with police and young black men. And it's anything goes summer, too. And meanwhile, in Iraq, Mr. Maliki, al-Maliki, is saying, hey, you know, you can't kick me out. I run this country. He's essentially becoming Saddam Hussein. And so keep your eye on that box. It's going to be very, very interesting. Meanwhile, the Kurds are looking for the exit door. All that said, in the middle of all this, you've got the Hobby Lobby decision where the Supreme Court said a corporation can have a religion and can basically impose that religion on their employees, because after all, they're just employees. They're not citizens or anything. It's not like the government should be protecting their rights. They're employees. This is a contract, you know, financial thing. And so they're just serfs. So they have to comply with the religion of the corporation. And so the Satanist Church, the Satanic Temple, the Detroit chapter of the Satanic Temple is saying, well, if that's true, you know, our religion, we're a nonprofit corporation too, and our religion says that we should be able to get an abortion without having to hear a lecture about how it might be bad for you. And so we want to do away with these mandatory, you got to read them the list thing laws. And Brian Fisher had some thoughts about that. Brian Fisher, of course, the host of Focal Point Radio Show on AFR Talk, Director of Issue Analysis for Government and Public Policy at the American Family Association, AFA, American Family Association, AFA.net is the website. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Tom, good to be with you.
So, not to get off on too much of a tangent, but I'm curious if, you know, today apparently Shep Smith accused Robin Williams of being a coward or words to that effect for committing suicide. I'm curious your thoughts on the suicide of this man.
My only thoughts, I'm just sad. I'm sad for Robin Williams. I'm sad that his life is at a point where he felt like he had to take such a drastic action. I'm sorry for his wife. I'm just sorry for his children. Terrible, terrible things. I'm just grieving with his family.
Okay. I'm absolutely with you on that. I think that there's, you know, some suicide shaming going on, and I think it comes out of a place of people being afraid of suicide, and there's a whole societal taboo against it. There's certainly a religious taboo against it. And some religions, you don't go to heaven if you commit suicide and those kind of things. But anyhow, let's talk about this other one. You on your radio program recently asserted that while Hobby Lobby, a corporation, should have a First Amendment right to religion, and that the founders of our the framers of our Constitution put religion both in the First Amendment and in the Establishment Clause, that there should be no establishment of religion and no religious test, that they did that to protect exclusively Christians, not Jews, not Muslims, not Satanic Temple members, Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, etc. Do I have that right?
Yeah, actually, Joseph Story said that. He was the longest-serving associate justice in United States Supreme Court history. He was appointed by James Madison. He wrote the first definitive history of the Constitution. And Joseph Story said that the object of the First Amendment was to protect religious liberty for the various Christian denominations. It wasn't to deal with anything else.
So right. He said basically that it was to prevent the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists from going to war with each other. And,
right.
You know, there is some historical evidence that was a concern. I mean, Jefferson talked about that in his famous, I have declared on the altar of God the unyielding opposition to any kind of oppression of the minds of men, when he was actually talking about priests. He was talking about the church that he was opposed to, that he was declaring unyielding opposition to. And it's interesting that that's the top of the Jefferson Memorial. But Joseph Story wasn't even born when the Declaration of Independence was written. He was 8 years old when the Constitution was written. I get it that he was, you know, he was a long-serving Supreme Court justice, an ardent opponent of slavery, a good guy in a lot of respects. He was making almost three times as much by the time he resigned from the Supreme Court as an author than he was as a Supreme Court justice. And so there's a lot of things that he wrote that you can quote from that may or may not be true. I think, you know, that quote, I don't know if he later repudiated it or not, but that quote is just simply wrong. I mean, Jefferson came out bluntly and said that that, you know, that Jefferson, George Washington, I mean, there's no shortage of claims. But beyond that, I mean, in this day and age, to say that the First Amendment only covers Christians, doesn't that make you the same as ISIS?
No, because what it does, Tom, is it reserves religious expression entirely to the states. The First Amendment protects religious liberty for the states. The states can do whatever they want. If a state wants to make Satanism the official religion of their state, they can do that. The First Amendment protects religious liberty and authority.
Brian, I would encourage you very strongly to go back and look at your history of Massachusetts incorporation into the Federation under the Articles of Confederation when Massachusetts first joined the United States, and later when they had the debate over signing the Constitution. Massachusetts had to alter their state constitution because it was the only state that basically provided for theocracy, for things like a tax that went directly to the church. They had to modify that just to get into the United States. I mean, history says that, you know, this assertion you're making is just not factual.
Well, Tom, your history is in error. At the time of the founding, there were 9 of the 13 original states had established churches in their states. The purpose of the First Amendment was to protect the freedom of states to
and
do that.
And all of them were gone by the time they ratified the Constitution.
No, you're wrong about that, Tom. The last state establishment wasn't abolished until 1833.
Which state? What religion?
I think it was Connecticut was the last one to abolish their established religion, but 9 of the 13 at the time the Constitution was enacted, 9 of the 13 states had established Christian denominations as the official church of their state.
Okay, let's say you may well be right. This is news to me. So let's say that that's the case. First of all, that kind of blows out the supremacy clause. If the Constitution says, you know, our law supersedes state law, well, but we're getting in the weeds here. Again, this is 2014. We have a religiously diverse population of the United States. How can you assert that the Constitution of the United States should protect you as a Christian and it should not protect somebody who's a Jew or a Muslim?
Well, actually, Tom, the First Amendment prevents the federal government, it prevents Congress from interfering with anything that state governments want to do with regard to the free exercise of religion. So it prohibits Congress from interfering with whatever states wants to do. If states want to establish Islam as the official religion of their state, they can do it, and Congress is not allowed to intervene. That's freedom. That's supremacy, Tom.
Yeah. Somehow I don't think so. The 14th Amendment. I'm sorry? Privileged immunity clause. Yeah. Okay, yeah. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And the supreme law of the land is the Constitution. So, you know, what you are saying may have been true prior to the 1870s when the 14th Amendment was passed, but it's certainly not true now.
Well, you're wrong about that.
Yep.
The wording of the First Amendment to the states in 1876 never got out of Congress. Congress tried to incorporate the Bill of Rights against the states in 1876, didn't do it. First Amendment still means today what it meant then.
Okay. Brian Fisher. Host of Focal Point Radio, AFA.net. Thank you, Brian.
All right, Tom, you're welcome. Anytime.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So shall we start lobbying one of the states to establish the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monsters, their official church state religion? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And amazing. Michelle in Venice, California. Hey, Michelle, thanks for watching over on our website at tomharbin.com. What's up?
Good morning, Tom. Well, what's up is we've got a constitutional crisis here in California where yesterday the California Supreme Court ordered our Secretary of State to remove Prop 49 from the November ballot. Prop 49 is the Overturned Citizens United Act.
Right.
Money out, voters in. It's a voter instruction.
What was the basis for that declaration?
Well, they have two. One is that voter instructions have no value and do not belong on the ballot. We believe that there's a long history of this. And that
you mean voter initiatives?
No, not voter initiatives, voter instructions or voter advisories. This was a non-binding advisory measure, much like what folks of WAMEND were trying to put on the ballot.
Sure.
We've had these.
So in other words, this doesn't have the force of law, and they're saying if it doesn't have the force of law, then why bother? Or you shouldn't
exactly,
do it.
Exactly. Right. In fact, within the opinion that we were very disappointed to read from Goodwin Liu, who Jerry Brown appointed to the bench, whom progressives fought to have on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, was saying if the legislature wants to hear what the people think about this, they should conduct a Gallup poll. So that was one argument. I know, right? The other argument was that the legislature acted illegally and this is just sort of the machinations of legislature. We did not actually meet the Secretary of State's sort of done and dusted deadline of June 26th. It was extended for another week. We passed out of the assembly on the 3rd of July and then went to Governor Brown's desk where he did not sign our bill into law, but he allowed it to go to the ballot without his signature, which actually is part of the problem. He did sort of open up and invite this challenge, which was...
Does Jerry Brown not want this thing to be on the ballot? Apparently he doesn't.
Well, here's the deal.
Why?
There is a tremendous institutional resistance to voter advisory measures. We confronted this on our... quest to get this on the ballot through the legislature.
So this is not about the substance of whether or not the people disagree with Citizens United. This is about the legal nuance of what kind of things should be on the ballot?
And also there is a fear that if one voter advisory gets on the ballot, it will simply open the floodgates to voter advisories and the people will be telling their legislators what to do about all kinds of matters, and we can't have that.
Right.
Right. It's really elitist. Yeah, indeed. Right. Indeed. So it's quite shocking.
So is there any appeal to this, Michelle?
Well, here's what will happen. This will be heard in court on or before the 10th of September. So they have not rendered a decision.
Uh-huh.
They have simply said, take them off the ballot and let's have a hearing.
Right.
So if.
By then, will it be too late to put it back on the ballot?
Yeah. Or it would be one of those horrific supplemental ballots, which we definitely don't want. That's
right.
$4 or $5 million. We would love to, if I can stay on after your break and tell folks what they can do about this.
You can just tell me right now, and I'll repeat it.
Go to our website, yes, on ca49.com. Sign our letter of outrage.
Okay. ca49.com, right, Michelle?
Yes, okay. On ca49.com.
Thank you. Oh, yes, on CA. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me, with you. With me was Brian Fisher. We had a caller a few minutes ago who was saying yes on 49.com. Let me write this down and get back to it after the break. I need to check this website out myself before I plug it on the air. That said, should the states begin establishing their own religions? I don't think so. I don't know. Anyhow, there's that. But the thing that I wanted to talk about with regard to suicides, did we ever find that Shepard Smith clip? You've got it? Let me hear that. I'd like to hear what Shepard Smith had to say about this.
One of the children grieving tonight because their father killed himself in a fit of depression. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? You could love three little things so much, watch them grow, and they're in their mid-20s, and they're inspiring you and exciting you, and they fill you up with a kind of joy you could never have known, and yet something inside you is so horrible, or you're such a coward, or whatever the reason, that you decide you have to end it. Robin Williams at 63 did that today.
Yeah. Well, yesterday. Maybe the day before, depending on, you know, it's around midnight. But in any case, that wasn't quite the condemnation of Robin Williams that I had been led to believe by the headlines. But suicide is a really, really touchy thing. I've had two friends. A very, very close friend of mine recently, former business partner, Terry O'Connor. Terry and I started two businesses together in Michigan back in the 70s. We had known each other before that. We've kept close all these years. I mean, we started this business in 72, as I recall, maybe 73. And Terry died a few months ago of mesothelioma, which is what my father died of. And it's an extremely painful death. And the last months are just mind-bogglingly painful. And I was, every weekend, I was on the phone with Terry or on, we would use the iPhone video chat thing, you know. And so we could look at each other and talk. He lived down in Florida in the Keys. And he was just in so much pain. And I often thought, you know, at some point in there, I would commit suicide rather than deal with that kind of pain. I think. I mean, who knows? Right? Who knows? And apparently Robin Williams was suffering a psychic pain of that level. This Terry's pain was physical. And it's almost like if, as a parent, the other thing that I've known throughout my life is I've known several people who were really, really wounded by the fact that their parent had committed suicide. Or a parent, one of their parents had committed suicide. And they feel guilt about it. Like, you know, what could I have done to stop that? And so it has occurred to me that if one were going to commit suicide, trying to make it not look like a suicide would probably be a good idea. But I think that there's a serious fear of this discussion in our society and a serious fear of, you know, where do we go with this? I mean, for people who are in physical pain, there's not a lot of debate. We've done shows on this before where we've had experts on, and, you know, Washington State and Oregon both have right to die with dignity laws, where two doctors can certify that you're terminal and you're in excruciating pain, and, you know, here's an overdose of barbiturates, and if you want to use it, good luck. But what about mental pain? Which then raises the question of our mental health system. And what about addictions? Which raises the issue of, you know, Robin Williams had recently gone through, you know, gone back to rehab, had recently dried out again. And my understanding of the nature of addiction is that sometimes early on in that, gee, I just dried out process or gee, I just withdrew process, that's the hardest part. I mean, it certainly was for me, kicking nicotine. And, you know, you can't sleep for weeks, and I mean, it's not suicidal, but it's pretty damn awful. And you just wonder, you know, might there have been other things available? Yet here's a guy who had everything. You know, he had available to him anything that money can buy, and it didn't work. But the shaming of people who commit suicide, I have a real problem with. And I'm pleased, actually, to see that our media, I thought Shep Smith was the exception to this, apparently he's not, that our media, by and large, are simply saying, you know, we're really sad to see him go. Just like with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died of a heroin overdose, which, you know, is a perfect platform for the pontificators and the moralists among us to start wagging their finger. Almost none of them did. None of them took that opportunity. And instead, we simply remembered the life of an extraordinary actor. Here, this is the second. I mean, not the same thing. arguably another person dying by addictions.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, a lot on the table. What do you think about religion in America and your thoughts on Shep Smith, your thoughts on Michael Brown? We're going to do that in some detail in the next hour. Good, the bad, and the very, very more rigorously ugly, the good. Richard William Riggs. On Friday, the retired Oregon Supreme Court Justice came out in support of Measure 91, a ballot measure that would legalize marijuana in the Beaver State. In a video put together by Yes on 91, a group that supports pot legalization, Riggs said that trying to use the justice system to fight drug use was a waste of resources. Check it out.
Using the criminal justice system to enforce certain societal social norms is kind of a waste of resources. It takes away from the criminal justice system dealing with forcible rapes and murders and so forth. I've read this measure, and I'm going to vote for this measure. And I think anybody who reads the measure and gives it careful thought will probably join me in that vote.
I couldn't agree more, Judge Riggs. It's time for a sensible approach to pot policy. Ending prohibition isn't just the right thing to do, it's the practical thing to do. The bad. Eric Erickson. In an interview with the Houston Chronicle over the weekend, the conservative blogger and founder of RedState.com said he doesn't understand the reaction people had to him calling Texas gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis an abortion Barbie. Erickson said, "The phrase was intentional to discredit Wendy Davis, but I never thought about Barbie as something that demeaned women. I have an 8-year-old daughter who loves Barbie." Really, Eric? You can't see why it's demeaning to call a prominent female politician a Barbie? Unbelievable. And the very, very ugly Mark Fuller, the district court judge who presided over Karl Rove's kangaroo court prosecution of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, which you can read all about at www.free-don.org, now has another mark on his record. On Saturday, the judge was arrested by Atlanta police for assaulting his wife. He has now been formally charged with misdemeanor battery. First you help railroad an innocent man on behalf of Karl Rove and his cronies, then you beat your wife. Stay classy, Mark. That is very, very ugly. That's amazing. Annie, Judy in Hesperia, California. Hey, Judy, thanks for watching. What's up?
Well, I wanted to talk to you about Shepard's remark about Robin Williams being a coward.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He truly showed his ignorance in that remark. I was a suicide crisis counselor for 2.5 years, worked a hotline where when people were feeling suicidal, they could call us and we would get them through it.
Right.
And the big thing I think a lot of people don't understand about suicide is that suicide is the great fooler, the great disguiser. People are having some kind of issues they need to deal with. They're struggling to deal with them. They go into a deep depression. They're looking for a solution. And that's when suicide will kind of jump up and go, "Hey, hey, look at me. Here I am. I'm your way out."
Right.
And because people are so deeply depressed, they frequently don't recognize that suicide is actually death. Now, if part of them does kind of have that spark of recognition, that's when they'll often reach out for help. That's when they would call us on the helpline.
Right.
And I think that people need to understand what I've heard on a lot of other stations. Robin Williams was a deeply depressed individual, and suicide comes out of depression.
Right.
It's, you know, and I think that is a really important thing to hang on to. The idea that it disguises itself. Obviously, he did not recognize it as death. If he had recognized it as death, he might have called a hotline, or he might have reached out to somebody for help. Maybe that's what he was doing a month ago when he went to that facility in Minnesota that they talk about went into. Maybe he was recognizing that suicide is death.
Right. Well, I've read reports that he not only was struggling with addiction issues, but he also might have been struggling with what used to be called manic depression is now referred to as bipolar disorder, which is treatable. But in the depressed phase of manic depression, people get to some pretty dark spots.
Yes, they do. And I think the thing is that he was a tremendous, tremendous individual. I think personally, I was a tremendous fan. I cried when I heard it.
Yeah.
When I look at him, I think in every time we saw him act, we really did see a little bit of him coming through.
Sure. I think you do with any actor, frankly, but yes.
Well, I don't think so. I think that was his gift, that he could be acting, and yet we could see a little bit of him,
right.
Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And I think that, as his wife said, we want to focus on his life. We want to use this opportunity to educate people to what suicide is really all about. Mm. And I think Mr. Smith needs to make a public apology.
Yeah. And the carry away message, Judy, from what you're saying is that suicide is death, and people need to get that. And if they're thinking about suicide, they need to realize all the consequences that will happen to everybody in their lives that will be associated with their death. It's not just going to be the relief of their pain. It's going to be the beginning of pain for a whole lot of other people, among other things.
Well, what we used to do is the first question we would always ask is, so are you thinking about committing suicide? When the person would say yes, we'd ask them, well, how do you expect to do it? They'd tell us, and then we would, as you just said, start talking to them about, well, now, who's going to be affected by your death and who's going to be left behind?
Right.
And it could go anywhere from their wife to a child, even to a pet. And then we would say, well, like you just said, we would try to hook them into, okay, well, think about that wife or that child or that pet.
Right.
And we would try to give them something to hang on to. And then we would get them give us a promise that, they would get help.
Right.
And we wouldn't let them off our line until they gave us the promise that they were going to get help and that they would not commit suicide until they got help.
Yeah, this is called, in an NLP, it's called an associative process. You're bringing them into the moment, and then you're asking them to connect to a future in which they're not there, and notice and then associating a pain with that future. So, okay, let's avoid that.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
People are chronically suicidal. We had a young woman who used to call us periodically, and she was chronically suicidal every single day. She dealt with it.
Right.
And sometimes, even though she had a physician and she was getting, ongoing help, sometimes she couldn't get to her ongoing help. She would call us.
Right.
And that's what it sounds to me was going on with Robin Williams, that he was dealing with this issue his entire, for many, many years.
Well, we don't know, but I'm trying to talk about this in a little more abstract context because it's not, had I known Robin Williams personally, I might be having an entirely different conversation right now, but I didn't. I never met the guy. So I think as much as there's a certain false intimacy as a consequence of celebrity, we all think that we knew him, but I can tell you from, knowing a few people who everybody thinks they know, that you really don't know somebody unless you really know them. And I think that speaking in the more abstract context is better, which you're doing, Judy. You just did a marvelous job. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the information on that. Beth in Paso Robles, California. Hey, Beth.
Oh, hey, Tom. I just wanted to ask the guy that you had on a little bit ago about the religion in certain states and stuff. Well, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and I listen to your show. My pastor, his wife, we all listen to your show. And I wanted to know if this was to come about, hopefully it doesn't, are we, as Seventh-day Adventists, are we going to have to observe a Sunday Sabbath instead of a Saturday Sabbath? Or
well,
are we going to be...
That's the way it was in Massachusetts prior to Massachusetts joining, signing the Constitution in 1787. Prior to that, they had a state tax, and you were taxed to support the church. And the various cities had people in the city who on Sunday would go out and find people who were not in church and drag them out in the public square and put them in stocks to humiliate them. In some cases, even whip them. They would take roll at church, call for attendance, make sure everybody was there. I mean, that's why I said, what's the difference between you guys and ISIS other than, you're not cutting people's head off. It's a kinder, gentler version of ISIS.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm also wondering, is there money to be made in religious persecution? Is this
of course
why
there is.
I think it's coming about right now.
Of course there is. The largest, most powerful corporation in Europe for the better part of 700 years was the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're still covered in gold. It's like, you know, Louise, yeah. I went to the Vatican to meet the Pope, but it's like everywhere you look, it's gold. It's just amazing.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. That's all I had to ask.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much, Beth, for the call. We just have 40 seconds here, so it wouldn't be fair to put a caller on. But I just, you know, the backstory that I think people don't know of the Constitution and of the writing of the Constitution and of things like the Establishment of Religion Clause and the Religious Test Clause and the First Amendment, is that the Pilgrims and the Puritans came to Massachusetts in the 1600s. Now, this was the 1700s that this document was written. And for 100 years, for four or five generations, in that state, women were murdered or tortured for being witches. They were unable to, they had absolutely no rights at all. If you didn't go to church, you would be prosecuted, not just persecuted. I mean, religious, you know, Massachusetts was the most religiously intolerant state in the Union throughout the 1600s and the early 1700s, to the point where young Ben Franklin, at the age of 17, left Massachusetts and moved permanently to Philadelphia, where the atheists hung out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, he was having none of it. He said, I early absented myself from their assemblies. Yeah, I'll do that. And welcome back to our Free Speech TV viewers. Bob watching Free Speech TV in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. We're having a cold civil war.
Yeah, I think it's a constitutional crisis for bureaucrats and people who are working in that field. But for most people in this country, it's a cold civil war. I mean, look at what's going on in St. Louis. Look at what's going on in the Midwest. We've got decriminalization of marijuana in Colorado, a state where it's actually difficult to grow hemp or marijuana. Compared to some of these southeast states who won't have anything to do with it. And we can't even get an honest discussion amongst climate change scientists about the value of industrial hemp versus the crime of cannabis prohibition. You know, so I think we're having a cold civil war. It's a constitutional crisis for the elite.
Yeah.
And that's the way I see it.
So the culture wars never went away. I mean, we've always had culture wars in the United States, all the way back to the founding of the Republic. We've always had culture wars in the United States. You know, people who simply have
people
different
in prison. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
I think it's wrong to throw people in prison. I think most reasonable people would agree that you don't throw people in prison for growing a plant that can help your economy and the environment.
Agreed.
Now, what is the answer to that?
Well, the answer to that is really simple. We do what Ecuador Portugal have done is we decriminalize all drugs.
What we do, we say let's end prohibition,
yeah,
and let's allow people to grow marijuana for their own personal use,
yeah,
and to gift each other with, and let's encourage corporations to grow industrial marijuana,
yeah,
for the sake of the planet and the economy, and let's employ people doing that. Let's go to work agriculturally. Let's do that.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? Why criminalize that? Why marginalize inner city people or Indian people or white people who want to be gardeners and farmers?
Yeah.
Why marginalize people? Why continue throwing people in jail, threatening people? This is not
Bob, you're preaching to the choir, but you know you're absolutely preaching to the choir.
I'm discussion about a constitution.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Bob, for the call. Philippe in Canovanas, Puerto Rico. Do I have that right, Philippe? Philippe is listening to his radio. Okay, we'll put him on hold. Oops, and get back to him a little later on. Bob's thing about cannabis, you know, it's. We are not, I mean, we've got a public health disaster in the United States right now. You've got millions of people who are experiencing depression. It's true, but it's also glib to say that a lot of people who are experiencing depression are experiencing it for what are called exogenous causes, external causes. Their unemployment ran out. They're losing their home. Their wife is divorcing them, or husband. Their family is falling apart. Their kids are locked in. There are people who are experiencing and sometimes suicide comes out of that. But we have an economic public health crisis in the United States. But then there's also a very real mental health. And you could argue, I suppose, at some level, spiritual health, the public health crisis in the United States that we really haven't paid much attention to, and we really should be. We'll get back to that. So, 10 minutes before the end. Janine in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Janine, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I know there's a lot of discussion right now going on around Robin Williams and the issue of suicide. And, I survived an attempt in the Dark Ages in 67.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout my life, I've heard people make comments about, how incredibly selfish that is of people, to take that way out. And, I've had a good many years of living, thankfully, since that time. But I can tell you that for all of the professionals who speak, nobody knows. Nobody knows how dark those places get.
Mm-hmm.
And you are not thinking rationally, of course, at the time, because you cannot possibly see any way out. And I was interested in what one of the previous callers said about how people don't have the concept of it being death.
Right.
And I would agree with that, because I think that in that moment, it is just so hard and so impossible that you just need to get out of it.
Yeah.
You need to get out of it, and you're not developing it out, any further than that.
Yeah, people need the psychological equivalent of a window being opened, so that they can get out of that dark spot and into a little bit of light, or at least into a future that has some possibilities. Janine,
right.
Thank.
Well, we're talking about a lot of people that have access or not. You know, things have changed exponentially in that regard.
Right.
But, who knows when that moment hits you? And, who knows if you even want to pick up that telephone and make that call and say, I need help.
Yeah, I'm with you. Janine, thank you for your contribution to our conversation and for your call. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, Establishment of Religion?
Yeah. You sent me back to a book called What Hath God Wrought, written by a guy named Howe, H-O-W-E,
uh-huh.
Covers America, 1815 to 1848. And it points out that, what the fellow was correct about one thing, at least, that the states did have established churches. I think Massachusetts went until 1833.
Connecticut was 1833,
18, I think that this book says this. But anyway, so it sent me back to it because I remember that it seemed to me from reading this thing a few years ago that mostly against that clause of the Constitution was mostly against the Anglican Church, because so many other mostly Congregationalists were receiving state money. And eventually when that was pulled, they actually thought it would be free religion, and that was being influenced to some extent by state money. And the 14th Amendment in 1867, about the 14th Amendment saying that there was a ruling actually in the 1900s that said that it applied the 14th Amendment to the states, even though initially it wasn't. So, going all the way back to the beginning is kind of a problem in that there's so many things that have happened since then.
Right. We had slavery back then. Women had no rights back then.
Right.
Do we really want to go back and say, okay, that's the era that we should emulate?
Yeah, well, I mean, on my side of it, I kind of think, in a sense, we should, because in the very beginning, there were no countrywide corporations.
That's true, too. You're right. You're right. The early corporations, in fact, were public-private enterprises like the Erie Canal Corporation that were started by government agencies and looking for private investors in order to accomplish some public good. In fact, the Erie Canal Corporation is one of the very first.
Yeah. And shareholders had to fork over money when they needed it. They didn't get it from other places.
That's right.
So you actually had a liability if you were an owner.
That's
so
right.
I was going to recommend this book. It's very interesting because I'm not a religious person at all. And, it tries to point out, there was a lot of infighting between the religions. Yeah. They all wanted that money.
I'll have to check it out. What Hath God Wrought is the book.
Right? Yes, it is. This guy named Daniel Walker Howell.
Okay. I'll check it out. Richard, I want to move along here. But thank you for your call. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle, you wanted to get back to Robin Williams?
Yes, please. Sorry, this topic gets me really frustrated when I hear comments like coward, and I'm hearing a lot of false equivalencies between Robin Williams' suicide and the death of Michael Brown. But primarily I wanted to...
I don't think there's any equivalency at all. They're completely different things.
Exactly. They're two totally different things, and they're being mashed together. But the point I wanted to bring up for people to think about suicide this way. Cancer is a disease that can oftentimes lead to death. Right. We do not blame a person who has died of cancer for their death. Depression is a disease of the mind that oftentimes leads to death. Why is it in this case that it is acceptable to blame the person who died for their disease?
Excellent point. Excellent point. And that was my point about, we don't have a word for this. I mean, men who trash women, there's this whole slut-shaming thing that's become a new phrase in our culture. But suicide shaming has not yet become a popular phrase, but it's what I think some people engage in, thinking, incorrectly, that if they can simply... in advance humiliate somebody, that person won't commit suicide.
Well, and I think people need to stop and think their thoughts all the way through when it comes to shaming for suicide. Oftentimes you hear the comments about, oh, what has this done to their family? Look what they've done. They've left their children. They've left their wife. This is terrible. This is shameful. Well, the person who's made that comment now is telling those surviving family members, you should feel ashamed yourself.
Or angry. Although when somebody dies of cancer, it's not unusual for people around them to feel angry. Not with that person, though, but with the cancer or with a society that produces carcinogens like there's no tomorrow. Michelle, thank you for the call. Excellent, excellent points. We'll be back. Joe Madison's going to drop by. Stick with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's most recently happened. Welcome back to the program. Most recently happened in Ferguson, Missouri, although this is nothing new. This is something that goes back to the founding of this republic. In fact, it goes back to the the initial population of this continent by people from Europe who were bringing people from Africa as slaves and others as well, and enslaving Native Americans and everything else.
Yeah, you're very good. I mean, you're absolutely right. Michelle Alexander has written a book that many people are quoting now that gets into the history of the criminal justice system as it relates to particularly African Americans. Yeah. I mean, it's you're absolutely on target in terms of the history.
And the voice you are hearing is Joe Madison. Joe Madison is with us for the hour. He's the host of the Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 110. The website, joemadison.com. His Twitter, @Madison Sirius XM. And Joe, what are you hearing on your show about this most recent outrage?
Well, let me.
We reached a tipping point.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think we've reached the tipping point. Let me work my way backwards. This morning, I interviewed a NAACP national board member who is from St. Louis County. And I should point out, I lived in that area. I went to school there, a graduate of Washington University of St. Louis, and lived in the area for a couple of years while attending school. And this is interesting. He said yesterday they had a rally, but it was at a church. Over 1,500 people attended peacefully. There was not one act of violence. The president, the new CEO, president of the NAACP, spoke. There were even more people outside who couldn't get in. And as I pointed out to the young man, I think his last name was Gaskin, I pointed out to him that the sad thing is we heard very little news about the peaceful rally at this church. Very little discussion. Today we're supposed to find out the name of the police officer. That's been kept a secret. There is still a lot of rumors. The grandfather of Michael Brown has been pleading with people to stop the rioting, stop the looting. This is not how Michael Brown would have wanted. The Justice Department, the FBI, they are looking over the shoulders of the St. Louis County Sheriff. Now, remember, the little town is no more than, I think, a little over 15,000 population. Right. The African-American population is, I think, something around 30%. But this clearly, and there's so much controversy. I mean, the rumors are that there were two young men walking in the street. A police officer drove up in a squad car, told them to get the F out of the street. And apparently Michael Brown said, look, I didn't think it's a law against walking in the middle of the street. And it's supposed to be one of these communities where it didn't have sidewalks. There's some controversy about that. Mm-hmm. And then
that actually adds a whole other dimension.
Yeah, and so I'm only going by what people are calling in who live there say. Then right. Some people say, no, there are sidewalks there, so we'll find out. Right. But that the officer, for some reason, now this is what eyewitnesses are saying, got upset, pulled out his gun, fired at, and glazed Michael Brown, who then realized he had been shot, turned around, put his hands up in submission. And the officer shot him, and it is reported, 8 times, once in the face and then apparently 7 body shots. Now, this is according to the young man who was walking with him.
Right, who's been doing interviews with
now we're starting,
media.
That's right, who's now been doing interviews with national media. So what people are trying to do now is maintain the peace, allow the FBI to look over the shoulders of the St. Louis County Sheriff. That's who's doing the investigation with the FBI, because a lot of people think the FBI is doing the investigation. Not really. They're simply validating, verifying as an independent body, which is good. Because Eric Holder, I must tell you, I'm very pleased with the way he responded. He didn't wait a week. He didn't wait 3 weeks. He said, look, we're on top of this. Right. And now witnesses are being interviewed, and we'll see. And that's where we are at this point in time.
There's a there's an issue of class that I see being played out as an issue of race as well that I wanted to get your thoughts on. Setting aside race for a moment, in the United States right now, there are mostly conservatives and Republicans who will come on this program or on your program and say that somebody who has not gone to college should be stuck with a minimum wage job their entire lives because they just didn't somehow accomplish it. Right? You know, they didn't make it.
You know, tell my father who worked at Buick Plant.
Right, or my dad who worked in a tool and die shop for 4 years.
Yeah, right.
But that, you know, you and I remember an America where work was respected for work, and everybody was viewed. Now, obviously, it was also a more highly integrated America, so there is a racial subtext to this. But at least among the middle class, both black and white, there was this sense that work was work. I'm hearing this story now in the media. It's getting heavy play in the media that this young man was 2 days away from going to college. And it almost sounds like, at least maybe for a white audience, that what CNN is communicating with that Chiron that I saw just a half hour ago is he's more deserving than just the average black person walking down the street confronting the cops because he was going to go to college, right? This is a bigger deal that we should pay attention to because he's one, you know, do you understand what I'm saying?
I think I understand what you're saying, but what comes to the forefront of my mind as you're talking, that police officer didn't know he was going to college. That police officer didn't know if he was middle class. He didn't know anything about this. And this is the mistake I think a lot of people make when they get into that kind of discussion. You know, when somebody, Malcolm X used to say this, when they lynch you, they don't lynch you because you're Baptist. They don't know if you're Baptist, Catholic, Buddhist. Yeah. You know, all they know is they see the color of your skin. And so what did that officer know? How could that officer know he was, matter of fact, he was actually going to technical school. He was going to work at a school that, because he was good with his hands, according to what his mother said, and it was a technical school.
Right.
But let's be quite candid. What did that officer know?
Right.
And no, the officer just saw somebody he's seen in the community. Let me give you some. It was very interesting because when we started talking about this, Ferguson is a small town. It's a population, a community of 15,000. And I'm reading now from the Ferguson Police Department.
Uh-huh.
This is racial profiling data from last year, 2013. Right. Population 15,865.
Right.
And listen to this. Key indicators, police stops, total of 5,384 police stops.
Right.
In 1 year, 886 were white, 4,632 were black.
And yet it's a 30% black population.
Too. And so 86% of all the police stops were black people. Then searches, people being searched on the street, net 611, 47 white, 562. Again, a town that's 30% African-American.
Right.
91% of all the searches of African Americans. And then arrest. 521 arrests last year. 36 white, 463 black. 92% of all the arrests in that one little town of 15,000 were African American. There was a problem before Michael Brown was shot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And those are the two things that I, or a couple of the things that I really wanted to get into, is one, the media narrative, which I was getting to, and to the reality on the ground. What is going on? Is it open season on black kids in the United States? Seems that it is. We'll be back. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Joe Madison right after this. We're back. We're back here with our Free Speech TV viewers. Joe, did you want to add something? I've got some callers here on
yeah.
the topic.
Okay, no, I didn't. I mean, the only thing I'm just simply saying, and you know, poor white communities could say, you know, we're victimized too. But
I don't think they are to the extent that black.
Well, I think that's because there's a class distinction. But that's what I'm saying. I don't think there's so much a class distinction. Let me give you an example. If I live in a middle-class neighborhood as an African-American, I can't tell you how many shows that I've done of people who have been stopped sometimes on their own property.
Sure.
You know, there's story after story, and I can't tell you how many times I've stopped. One of my favorite stories is Lou Gossett, who tells me when he first went to Hollywood, and he was a very successful actor, and they handcuffed him to a tree, and he's living in Hollywood.
Wow.
You know, and so there's where that class distinction tends to peel off.
Right. It becomes meaningless. And this is what, for example, in the 1850s, when the Irish came here and they were widely discriminated against, they were able to assimilate. In the 1890s, when the Italians came here and you had the gangs in New York, and ultimately they were able to assimilate because they were white.
And as you remember, and then the Irish got political power.
Yeah.
And of course, as we know, they started involving themselves in law enforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, look, the word.
Especially in Boston.
Thank you. But the word, and I found out you shouldn't use it anymore, police transportation units. I've been in a few and arrest protests. We used to call them what? Paddy wagons.
Yes. Yeah.
And
the patties were
the Irish.
Right, that's right.
Exactly.
Yeah. And coppers.
They wore the copper
buttons
that's
on their uniforms.
That's right.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. So it seems to me that, well.
See, look, let me give you an example. Dayton, Ohio. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. Beaver Creek is a suburb. There's this story we were talking about earlier. A guy walks in. He's shopping in Walmart. He goes to the toy section. Picks up a BB gun rifle, much the kind that I used to have when I was a kid, and he started walking around the store with it, and immediately folks got on their cell phone and called the police. The police show up, and I don't know if they told him to drop it, he didn't drop it. I don't have the slightest idea what happened.
They're suing for the footage from Walmart.
That's right, and they shot him. They killed him. He's on the phone with his girlfriend who's 3 or 4 aisles over. And she's listening to him being shot, and they shot the man. And then someone emailed me and said, but, whoa, wait a minute. You've got guys in Texas and other who are white walking in with guns on their hip, and no one says anything. I sent out a news release yesterday after my show, and I said it is open season on young black men. And quite candidly, now I'm not certain if you – I'll say this. I had to tell my son growing up in suburbia – Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., every time as a teenager he went out with his friends, you're different, his white friends, be careful, because driving while black, they'll pull you over. Now, I don't know if you had to tell your son that every time he left the house.
I never told my son that.
Every time I told my son that.
And the one time that my son ended up in jail
was when he was a black friend.
Was exactly.
I bet you. I didn't even know that.
He was with his best friend, whose name was also Justin. We called him Black Justin or White Justin. They were out together in Buckhead, the ritzy part of town. And Black Justin was actually much wealthier than us. These kids, they took him down. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have Joe Madison. Dear friend, more importantly, a highly respected colleague in the talk radio field.
Sirius XM colleague,
yeah.
Too.
And
right.
Indeed, yeah.
Yes.
Also on Sirius XM. Joe is the host of the Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 110, his website, joemadison.com. And, Joe, we do this for a living. You want to pick up a couple of phone calls here?
Yes, anything. It's your show.
Let's see. Well, you know, if you got something to add.
No, I think that we just, you know, the biggest fight I'm having, and it's really not a big fight, I shouldn't point that out, is that we've got to convince the young people, particularly in Ferguson, to not loot, not riot,
right.
Not get, look, they, first of all, we're finding out they really don't need any calls to go after you. That you've got an attorney general, Eric Holder, who responded immediately, who's on top of it, who has spoken about this, who's on record that goes all the way back to Trayvon Martin, that allow the process, because I know Al Sharpton's going in today, and I told my audience, I remember Memphis, Tennessee. I remember the fact that the FBI, and you've written about this, paid provocateurs
sure.
to create disturbance in what was supposed to be a peaceful, nonviolent march.
Yeah.
I don't put it past rogue cops, not all, but rogue cops, to pay provocateurs, to create violence. You get nothing out of this. And then you give these police officers an excuse that really don't need an excuse. I've got some people who are saying, oh, no, you know, they've got to riot. This is the way they express themselves. You're playing into their hands.
You know, I went through that same debate with the Occupy people, the Black Bloc people
yes.
from Occupy. They would come on my show and say, you know, we have to trash the buildings. We have to, you know.
No, you don't.
It's a blow against the capitalist system. And I'm like, no, you're just doing their, you know.
You're doing what they, that's right. You're doing really what they want you and anticipate you will do. And they're prepared for you to do it.
That's right. That's right. Basically just asking you to. So, and we were talking during the break, you know, some of our commercial stations didn't catch all of this, but. You and I were talking about how, as your son was growing up and in suburban Maryland outside Washington, D.C., and had white friends, you would say to him when he left the house.
Every day. Every time he went out. Every weekend he went out, I had to, because I was involved with NAACP. We even used to have, I remember a board member created a little pamphlet for black parents to put in the glove compartment of their car for their teenage children who were driving on how to act when the police stop you.
Wow.
Now, what white parent needs a pamphlet for their son?
None, I can tell you.
Yeah.
And in fact, as I said, the one time my son got arrested for being out in public, I think it's probably the only time he ever got arrested.
Yeah.
He and his best friend, who was black, 15 years old, in the ritzy part of Atlanta, the Buckhead part of Atlanta, at 10 o'clock at night, and police officers said to his black friend, you know, what are you guys doing here? And
mm-hmm.
my son talked back to the cop, and both of them ended up on their face on the ground.
This,
and we ended up at the police station
yeah,
with my son's parents trying to bail our kids out.
Now let me tell you, I think that and I'm going to offer a solution. My solution comes from Johnny Cochran when he was alive. And as you know, Johnny Cochran was a master at dealing with this issue. And I remember having a very lengthy conversation. And one of his strategies was, you sue, the parents sue. But you can't, there's not enough money in the world to bring back a child
sure.
who's been killed. So that it's not about the money that the parents get. But he always included in the lawsuit, the city or the municipality paid dearly.
Right.
To the point where if it happens again, you won't even be able to get insured.
Right. It's to the point where it's less expensive to hire good cops, pay them well, and train them and supervise them.
The word was training. And he always included in the settlement training.
Yeah.
And what they found out, where they had settlements like that and people were trained, officers were properly trained, they often didn't have repeat incidences. This is, I sometimes have to realize I'm not on Sirius XM. But
yeah, there's certain words we can't use.
But
thank you.
This is poor training.
Yeah. There you go. This is bullpucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am with you. Joe's Sirius channel. Oh, you're now channel 126. You're channel 126.
Yeah. Did you say 110?
Yeah.
They change it every summer.
Yeah,
no, I'm just teasing. It's channel 120. We're now in the news talk platform, which is
yeah.
where we're happy yeah. to be. Yes.
Okay. Joe Madison with us.
We're between you and the Patriot Channel.
Oh my!
I know it. That's what I said. Oh my!
strange place.
Yeah, strange neighborhood.
Okay.
Right.
Let's see. We got a minute or two here. Before we have to hit a break. Oh, we could just have 1 minute. Let me put Michael back on hold then, and we'll pick up your calls when we come back from the break. Do you think, Joe? I mean, I look back at this. This is minor compared to what happened in the 70s. And in terms of the rioting and things in St. Louis, do you think that things have really changed a lot in these 40 years?
No, I don't really think things have really changed a lot. However, there has been change. I think the change is, once again, you have an attorney general who grew up and has an empathy, not just a sympathy, but an empathy, who himself has been a target.
Well, President Obama talked
about it. And President Obama talked, Eric Holder talked about it. That makes a difference when you get in a position of power.
Right.
And you now control the Justice Department. There have been changes, but the attitude of some people still the same. It's still how people perceive people. Right. It's the perception of
and
how
this
I
is,
perceive
And this
you.
Is what has to change. We have to figure out as a society, how do we get past this?
Oh, you make it very expensive for municipalities. I mean, really.
As a starting point. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think there's a deeper cultural thing, too.
Oh, no question about that.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Joe and I will be picking up your calls right after this. Joe Madison with us, host of the Joe Madison Show. JoeMadison.com is the website. He's on SiriusXM Channel 126. No. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Joe Madison in the studio with us. My friend and colleague. He does the Joe Madison Show every weekday from 6 to 10 a.m. on SiriusXM Channel 126. His website, joemadison.com, Madison SiriusXM, the Twitter feed. And we've been talking about not just the Michael Brown shooting, but the state of affairs in America today as well. Joe, let's pick up some phone calls and see how this, what our listeners have to say. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. You're on the air with Joe Madison and me.
Hey, Mr. Hartman and Mr. Madison, about the killing of African-American Michael Brown, I really don't understand it, but like the stranglehold that killed an African-American man, I believe, in New York, I think it's a result of paranoia by the police in our society. You combine that with the militarization of our police forces, so I truly believe that our police are acting on a subliminal basic instinct of survival, not justifying it. But just what are your guys' thoughts on that? Thank you, gentlemen.
So you see all these TV shows that you know, look out for the people. The cops are all, you know, together, and the SWAT team, and there's a very much a us versus them mentality.
Yeah, but we're dealing with people who are supposedly trained.
Right.
I mean, this is part of their training. They go through extensive training. I think let's best be quite candid. There's a culture that perpetuates itself. I mean, you know, as he was talking, he's from California, and thinking about that state trooper. What is going through a state trooper's mind when he's on the side of a freeway physically with his fist beating a woman?
Right.
Who is, I mean, she's a woman and she's covering herself. What is going through your mind that you absolutely have lost it to the point that, you know, you're beating? What goes through the mind of New York police officers, so let's go all the way to the other side of the coast, and you're choke-holding somebody, and you have other officers who are around who, by the way, know the choke-hold is illegal, but no one says, stop it, that's illegal, you can't do it. And they sit there and they watch him. Oh, and then when the paramedics arrive, nobody starts resuscitation with somebody who is barely breathing.
Right.
What goes through the mind of people who are supposedly trained? So I think the caller has a very interesting point, but I think this culture perpetuates itself.
Well, I think it's actually getting worse, and here's why.
And why? But
because,
why?
Because the military-industrial complex is trying to offload all of this. I mean, they were making all this stuff for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now they are giving these vehicles, these giant tanks, these weapons of war, basically, to police forces. You've got, I mean, in the United States, on any given day right now, there's an average of 100 SWAT raids. Back in 1970, there were zero. I mean, this was...
Wow, I wasn't aware of that.
This is something that just, you know, didn't used to happen.
And let me tell you, we read a lot of the websites, and I can't verify this, but I read just this morning in prepping for my show that every 28 hours in the United States, a black man gets shot by a police officer.
Wow.
Now, I can't verify that. And it was, what was it, AltNet or AltNet reported that.
Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me. It would not surprise me. And so much of this stuff just goes under the radar.
It's, yes.
It's some little town in Mississippi, nobody knows.
But you know what, here's the big thing that has changed this, and this may be our salvation.
Social media.
The fact that this young lady is up on the balcony and she's she's everybody now can be a journalist.
Right.
So they pull out their iPhone. It's got a camera, and they can now sit there and so now you've got to confiscate
smartphones. They're passing laws against this.
They can pass all the laws. Look, I remember there was a time if you took a photograph of a police arrest, they'd take your camera. One of the times I got jacked up by a police department, I was in Detroit, and there was a rather odd arrest taking place, and I was actually working for a communication firm, and we were talking about police community relationships, and I'm taking photographs, and the cops came over and grabbed me and grabbed the camera, and this was in the late 70s. Now are we going to start watching police officers grab people's smartphones?
Oh, it's happening.
There you go.
It's happening all over, and you're seeing state legislatures passing laws saying it's illegal to film a police officer in the commission of his work, and the rationale is that he has to have his privacy protected. And wait a minute, he's a public citizen. And now the courts are getting in on this thing. And I'm not going to buy that one. Yeah.
That. I mean, you know, if that's the case, then we ought to stop court watching all these other things we're doing.
Yeah, we got Don in St. Louis, Missouri on the phone. Don, you're on the air with Joe and me.
Thanks, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Don, you're breaking up really bad. Is there any way that you can clean that up?
Be a different perspective if you like.
Yeah, Don.
Last Friday.
Don, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I've got to drop the call. You need to call from a different line or something. Because
what was his position?
I don't know. Okay. I just dropped it and I lost the comment. So yeah. Sabrina in McKinney, Texas. Sabrina, you're on the air with Joe and me.
Hello to two of my most favorite people in the world.
Thank you.
And I'm calling because, you know, this just breaks my heart. As an African American woman, I have two grandsons that I love very much. And for them to devalue our children's lives like that, and now, you know, you're seeing women being beat and choked. You know, it just really breaks my heart. I'm from Los Angeles, now living in Texas. But growing up, this is nothing new. Growing up, the young guys, as we grew up, they always told us about horror stories where they were pulled in the alleys by police. They were beaten. One of my grandson's grandfather was killed the same way Eric Wright was. And the family had a lawsuit, and they did win the case. But, you know, I mean, these people have such hatred for us. You know, and it drives me crazy because we're human beings. We're people too. And I'm still upset about Trayvon Martin when they didn't do anything. And it's the police. They support each other. They support this stuff. And it's not going to get any better. I don't think it is. I think a lot of those people come from the military and they come here. They're taught to kill. They get hired by the police department and they go out and they are racist. They hate our kids. They hate black people, period, and they're killing our kids. And it drives me crazy to keep hearing these stories one after another, and nothing is being done, nothing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you bring up Los Angeles. My wife, Sherry, is from Los Angeles, and she constantly tells me about she has two older brothers. She had one is deceased, but she grew up with two older brothers. And she says exactly what this young lady said, that young African American men would be arrested and they would hide them. Now, because she says she remembers her father and older brother going down to the precinct and saying, "Where is Baxter, the son?" And, "Oh, we don't know what you're talking about." And he's back in the jail. And they would hide them. They actually would hide them by not either putting them in the books or different name.
So they can beat them up?
Who knows? I mean, but the point of the matter is this is not new. Right. Now, once again, the difference is, and there will be people who will say, "Well, you know, we've changed." Yes, things have changed, nothing is absolutely the same the way it was. And what has changed is that there are people who are in position of power who are saying, "We're not going to tolerate it." But see, something is wrong. I think, for example, in Ferguson, that police officer should not be on paid leave.
Right.
I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, he should be in. I think he should be in jail.
Personally, I think he should be in jail too.
Yeah, maybe for his own protection.
Should be, because here's what, and I don't know what has happened on your show, but I have not had one police officer call my show when I made the argument. Now, maybe they'll start calling you, but not one has called my show when I made the argument. You know he's being groomed. He's being surrounded. He's being lawyered down. He's got the police union around him. And he's being prepped. You know that.
Yeah.
And we know that. And I challenge any policeman to call my show and tell me that that's not happening while he is free and out.
Well, in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the last time a cop really went down over something like this was Rodney King, and there were five or six cops involved, and only one of them really got nailed, if I'm remembering
right. I don't remember the exact number, but remember now, they also... That's
where Johnny Cochran...
That's right. That's where Johnny Cochran came in. And that's so you know, if there are police officers listening to me, the reality is they know I'm telling the truth. Matter of fact, I did have an officer... His name was Abdul. He's from New Jersey. He's a 26-year officer. And he says, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what's going on right now.
Yeah. Well, if there are any police officers listening, call in, and Danielle will move you to the top of the list. Oh, 5 seconds to the break. Okay, I got Jeff in Bridgeton, Missouri, wants to disagree with you about your statistics. But we'll pick that call up in a couple of minutes.
Oh, I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, because you got the printout right in front of you.
Ferguson Police Department printout. Right.
We'll be right back with Joe Madison, host of The Joe Madison Show, weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on SiriusXM Channel 126. Website, joemadison.com, and you can tweet him at Madison Sirius, SIRIUS. XM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of Joe Madison in just a second. We're back on the air. We'll have to consider that one. There you go. Let's see here. Bill says he works for a police department. He's watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Santa Maria, California. Bill, you wanted to share some insights with us. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Joe and Tom. I work for a West Coast, large police department for 14 years as a senior civilian, employee, and got some insights, as to how it works. There's a few things going on. There was a letter written into the local newspaper about police budget cuts here in Santa Maria, and the woman finished by saying, you know, cut everything, but do not cut police. There's kind of a feeling like, they're protecting us from those people. Second thing, the police, if they are involved in a shooting and they kill somebody, or an altercation and it goes to the grand jury. It went to the grand jury in the city I worked for. And the district attorney is a partner with the police department. They work together on everything. You know, the police arrest people, or the DA charges them and tries them and so on. So they're buddy-buddy, and the DA takes care of them, make sure that this cop is not, charged with murder or charged with anything serious. The DA has a lot of control over the grand jury. That's the way it worked in this city. For a serious offense, the cop would go before the DA. And, and then the DA would take very good care of the cop, unless it was really egregious. I mean, like caught on national TV with Brian Williams narrating the scene.
Right.
And even then, that doesn't always happen. Rodney King was a classic example.
Yeah.
We sat there and we watched police officers beat down Rodney King.
Yeah.
And it's still, we've seen this, and we've had eyewitnesses. What this caller is talking about is absolutely true. I mean, it's the old, prosecutors can indict a ham sandwich. I mean, and people know this.
They can also give a ham sandwich a pass.
That's right. And these young people, young people who are involved, unfortunately, in the criminal justice system, We know this, and I wish people would understand. There's nobody in the black community that I respect that wants crime to continue. I mean, we're all victims of it. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. We're more victimized by folks in the community than outside the community. But once again, I think that's why, and I'm not justifying, I think that's why young people are reacting the way that they are. Nothing's going to be done. The prosecutor's going to whitewash this. I don't believe the system works. They, you know, and many of them are in the system.
Right.
And they just simply lash out because there's despair. And where there's despair, there's often destruction. Right. And that's what you're sort of seeing. So then leaders have to go in and say, look, guys, give it a chance. Back off. It's not the way it used to be. I will get to the bottom of this. Thank God I repeat that the Justice Department is standing over the shoulders.
Right.
Of the prosecutor and the St. Louis County Police and watching every move.
We have leadership now.
I mean, we have leadership.
With not just integrity, but also with empathy.
That's right.
Joe Madison with us. We'll be back with more of Joe in just a second. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. Joe Madison in the studio with us, host of the Joe Madison Show, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 126. JoeMadison.com is the website. And taking calls for Joe and for me and Jeff in Bridgeton, Missouri. You wanted to challenge Joe? Do I have that right?
Yeah. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Jeff. You're on the
Hello,
air.
Hello, Jeff and Joe.
Actually,
I was just calling basically because, unfortunately, your guest has his facts completely wrong when it comes to the racial makeup of that area. Ferguson is 70% black, and it's about 30% white. And actually, that's not a small town. It's actually part of a very large area of North County, which is predominantly African-American. Now, maybe like 10 years ago, when white people started moving further west from the city of St. Louis, that's when African Americans started moving into that area. But also, the city of Ferguson controls a portion of a main interstate artery that also goes through St. Louis. So that might be why a lot of African Americans are pulled over in that area, just because it is predominantly African American in that community.
Let me stop you. I'm looking at this is what I can't look.
Yeah,
this is racial profiling data 2013 Ferguson Police Department population age 16 and over 15,865 key indicators stop 5,384. These aren't my figures. These are the Ferguson Police Department figures.
Right now, if I may, for a second. This population of 15,000 is over 16
and
so the
over.
Actual population is probably more like 30,000.
Exactly. So this is what we're talking about. Now give me a break. So you're sitting up here talking about 86% of the stops are African Americans, and that's because more African Americans happen to be driving through, which probably means they're profiled.
Right.
You know, and then when it comes to arrest, 92%. That's probably because they're being profiled. And it's this kind of crap that really bothers me, because the reality is I have a right to drive through a neighborhood, to drive through a community without being profiled by the local police. And I don't give a damn if it's 70% or 30%.
Yep.
So the reality is that when 91% of the people you search are of one demographics, you got a problem in your community. People are being profiled.
Yeah, there you go. Donnell in Las Vegas, Nevada, you are on the air.
Hey, great show, guys. I enjoy both you guys, and thank you for your services you guys do for the community.
Sure.
I just like to say, or should I say, I like to ask a question. Should there be some sort of diversity within the hiring of police and state troopers?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Well, even pair them up with people of different ethnic backgrounds.
I understand that. I'm sorry to interrupt. I understand with our fear of being corrected, but I understand Thank that you. There's only three African Americans on the Ferguson Police Department.
How big is the police department?
Well, I don't know.
30,000 people. It might only be 10 people on the police department.
But let's go back to the last caller. Oh, it's 70% black.
Yeah.
Then you're backwards. Absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So, but to respond to that, of course there must be more diversity. Absolutely, yeah. Because that's the importance of diversity. You bring a certain cultural understanding. That's why we want diversity in our universities. That's why we want diversity in our media, because I bring my I've said this on my show 100 times. I bring my perspective. Mm. You know, we've got something in common. Your father lived in Michigan, worked in a tool and die shop where my father probably couldn't work.
Yeah.
Probably couldn't get hired in a tool and die shop.
It was all white guys there, right?
That's why I said. Yeah. Now, my father worked in Flint, Michigan in a Buick plant. Mm-hmm. The majority of the black folk who worked in that Buick plant worked in the foundry. The dirtiest part of that Buick plant.
Yeah.
I have my perspective based on my experience. We come together. You share with me your perspective and how you grew up. I share with you my perspective and how I grew up. We find commonality.
Yeah.
And we often find that we're both probably have working class parents who tried to get their kids through college. And by the way, could get out of high school and work themselves into middle class America.
Yeah.
And we find we've got really more in common. Police departments, this caller is absolutely right, must be diversified.
Yeah.
They must be diversified, and it changes the culture of a community.
Well, it certainly has in the military in the last 50 years.
Well, that's what, matter of fact, the military led the way with diversity, if we remember, with Truman.
Yeah.
And it changed corporate America. It changed the military. You're absolutely 100% correct. And to a large degree, it changed America.
Yeah, agreed. Okay. Say that again. Googled it. There are 53 police officers in Ferguson.
53. That's not a big police department.
No. Yeah,
for 53. All right.
Steve in Chicago, we got 1 minute to the break. Steve, you got a quick one?
Yes, if I can. You're absolutely correct. I think we need more diversity. At the same time, recognizing that study after study indicates that there is a cultural line within police departments that irrespective of race, and declares that if you're Hispanic, white, black, that you protect your fellow officers.
Right.
And so even when we create diversity, we have found that police officers are going to protect other police officers. Having said that, I do think that technology can play a role. You know, we can mount cameras in cars. We can also put cameras now relatively inexpensively on the shoulders of every police officer out there.
Yep.
We can know what they say and do every day, and thereby we can ensure to some degree that there's accountability, because it's no longer his word against somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some empirical proof there, and we need to recognize that.
Yeah, we can do that fairly inexpensively. The cops are fighting this.
You can put cameras on guns.
Well,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's that technology is there right now.
Yeah.
That the camera sense. Can be on a gun.
But having it on his shoulder, with the recording.
You
know, where
the only thing you have to see, I'd rather it on the gun, because you can't turn it off.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you can.
There you go.
But you can
turn it. You want to stick around? You want to hang around?
It's your show. You
got
tell
a pile
me.
Of callers here. People like to talk to you.
I would love to.
Let's do it.
No
Let's
problem.
Do it. We got another hour with Joe Madison. We'll be back. Right after.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Joe Madison with us, host of the Joe Madison Show, 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM channel 126. JoeMadison.com is website. Madison Sirius XM is the Twitter feed.
Yeah, JoeMadison.net now, but I think...
Oh, it is?
Yeah, don't ask me. I, you know, they don't even allow me to tweet. they tell me it's .net, but if you do .com, it goes to .net.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
I guess.
Well, we got to get this stuff right.
Yeah, know, whatever.
.net. Okay.
Yeah.
Joe, we started out talking about Michael Brown being murdered.
Yeah. Being killed.
Being killed.
Right. Because I learned a lesson with. I was involved in a case. I was actually sued by the Prince George's Police Department. Because there was a case with a young man named Artie Elliott, who on my birthday was going home to his mother. His mother was having a birthday party, same day, June 16th, as I remember. And he was wearing a pair of shorts, tennis shoes with no socks, and not even a shirt. He was searched by the police officers. He was stopped because they claimed he was weaving. He had just been at Friday after work, had a couple of beers. They searched him, they handcuffed him, they strapped him in the front seat of the police cruiser, turned around, said he had a gun, and shot him 14 times through the police cruiser, through the window. Well, and the policeman got off. Let me tell you how powerful they are. I went on air and I said they murdered him. I was sued for defamation of character. Now, the lawsuit didn't go anywhere, but our attorney said all you had to do was say kill.
Right.
Murder is a legal term.
Right, right. Yeah.
That's how powerful this situation is. And this is what worries me about Ferguson. But again, here's the difference. The FBI, the Justice Department in the Artie Elliott case was nowhere around.
Right.
And the state's attorney was so afraid of the police union. Why? Because the state attorney had to get elected countywide.
Right.
And wanted, of course, to be the county executive, which he went on to be. And then, of course, he ended up in prison for taking bribes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the main messages, it seems to me, from Black America to White America is we're just people, too. And we tried to get White America to get that. Back in the 60s trying to deal with integration and segregation and busing and all this kind of stuff. And now, from what I'm reading, communities are
Tom, what changed you?
What changed
me? You grew up in a...
I grew up in an entirely white community.
Thank you. What changed you?
Well, I'm not, my father, and I'm not sure why, maybe because he was the son of immigrants. He grew up in Chicago. His experience in the army, I don't know what it was, but my father was not just tolerant. He was, well, for example, the girl next door to us, blonde white girl, 17, 18 years old, starts dating a black guy and then decides she wants to marry him. Her parents kicked her out of the house. She came to my dad and asked him if he would walk her down the aisle. He did.
So
And there was such an ostracization in that neighborhood. I mean, those people ended up moving out of the neighborhood.
Let me tell you what I've understood.
Where were you going with that?
Socialization.
Yeah.
That's really what it's about. When I think of people like Bradley, the basketball player, and I interview him,
right.
He said... I think of people like the former senator from Maine, who was Secretary of Defense, right. Cohen. You know, when I talk with them, the one thing that the common thread they have is socialization. Jack Kemp, used to the congressman from Buffalo, served on the board of Howard University, a historically black college, and I never will forget talking to him. And the last letter he wrote was to his children and grandchildren. He said it was socialization. It was getting to know people, working with people, having a commonality with people. I have said on my show, and I always use this as part of my speeches, in America, we are culturally conditioned to believe that white is superior.
Well, and, our language implies.
Well, that culture, don't change my
okay.
whole thing.
Okay.
That we are culturally conditioned to believe that white is superior and black is inferior. And the manifestation of that cultural conditioning is that black people are undervalued, underestimated, and marginalized.
Yes.
It's our culture. And our culture, and I always use a biological terms, a petri dish.
Yeah.
You drop something in it, what happens? A culture forms.
Right.
It depends on what you drop in it.
Right.
Now, and that's what happens. It's cultural conditioning. And so we have to recondition how we see each other. That's when you start, you talk about culture, you're talking about the Bible, you're talking about history, you're talking about clothes, you're talking about food. And if you constantly undervalue and underestimate and marginalize people, then that permeates through your whole psychic.
Right.
And sometimes it can be conscious, and a lot of times it's subconscious.
Sure.
And that's but look what's happening now. At that time, your father and that whole neighborhood changed, and the state, and I bet you during that time in the Commonwealth of Virginia, they couldn't have gotten married by law.
You're right. Well, this was 1969.
Barely could, and had to go to the Supreme Court to get married.
Yeah.
Had to go to the Supreme Court to get married because and I always tell people, colors don't fall in love.
Yeah.
People do.
Yeah.
People do. And that's where how you had a certain socialization, a certain reality. And that's why diversity is so important in everything we do, because it reconditions how we think. That's why I hear you talking about this and you know, about this impeachment. You are 100% correct. This is about going after President Obama's legacy. They don't care whether they're successful in finding him guilty. Impeachment is an indictment. History, which is part of our culture,
right? Yeah.
Will record. You elected the first black president, but we impeached him.
Yeah.
Now, we may not have found him guilty, but we impeached him.
And even if they don't do that, we've had 6 years of obstruction since the... caucus room conspiracy where these guys got together.
I talk about that caucus room conspiracy. I'm so glad you do. That is a true story.
Oh, yeah.
That was inauguration night.
Yeah.
2009. The caucus room. I pass it every day.
Yeah, I used to live in the building on the front
side.
Thank
you. That's right. And they met and damn near took a blood oath that we will not cooperate with this president no matter what he does, even at the expense of our own constituents.
Right. And who's the guy who replaces Eric Cantor, who was at the meeting? Kevin McCarthy, who was at the meeting.
Thank you.
It's like the system.
Newt Gingrich
at
the meeting.
Yeah. In fact, he came on this show and bragged about it.
I was listening to that show.
I mean, he was like, yeah, of course we did.
Really? Hey, yeah, that's what everybody does.
Yeah,
since when?
Yeah.
When didn't do it under Bush? You didn't do it under Clinton?
Yeah.
And that while everybody was celebrating a historical moment, these guys were conspiring. And damn near, I mean, I'm surprised they didn't cut each other and put their arm, how we used to do as
kids.
Well,
we don't know. I mean,
that's true.
Robert Draper's got a new book out called When the Tea Party Came to Town. It's a reissue of his original hardcover, which was called Ask Not What Good We Do with the United States Congress and How It Screwed Up or something like that. And he's a great historian. He's got the best story. It's in his book. It's When the Tea Party Came to Town. It's the introduction. He goes through the whole thing, quotes all these guys, just the whole setup. And then from there on down. So,
and it wasn't because Obama was a Democrat. No way.
For many of them, I think not.
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
We'll be back with Joe Madison. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman, Joe Madison taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Joe's website, joemadison.net. And welcome back. Tom Hartman and Joe Madison here with you. And let's pick up some calls here, Joe. Tom in Tucson, Arizona. This question, if you're going to ask the question, I think you're going to ask. Well, go ahead.
I'd like to ask both of you, why was there such a low incidence of crime during slavery?
How do you know there was a low incidence of crime during slavery?
From history.
Isn't slavery a crime?
Well,
I'd say every single day there was a crime going on.
I was sitting here thinking, slavery was a crime, at least a crime against humanity. And, you know, can I just be myself for a
please,
moment?
Please go off on
it. What the hell is that about? Well, I mean, what are you talking about? Whose crime? What crime? I mean, you have the Irish who are being prosecuted, persecuted as immigrants, and they were being arrested and thrown in jail and I mean, what are you asking? And what's the whole, I mean, what's the...
Here's a glimpse into, white guy's head.
Yeah, and then let's go immediately. That's why I say go read Michelle Alexander's new book. Yeah. Talking about how the criminal justice system was immediately used after slavery to slaves and people who were arrested were farmed out. I mean, you could be arrested as an African American for not having a job. And being
and then
on
put
the street
on a, in a labor
and then put
place.
In a and rent it out, right. Please.
Yeah.
Into know what insight there is. I mean, yeah. I don't know what that has to do with anything.
Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You got a comment for Joe?
Yeah, sure. I think we need to remember a story from about 6 months, maybe a year ago back, where a man was suing because the police department used a Minnesota multiphasic and an IQ test to exclude him because he had a somewhat higher IQ and was empathetic. They only want people with no empathy and lower IQ for the police. If you do that, you are pre-selecting for psychopaths.
Yeah, wasn't that in, like, Minnesapolis or Wisconsin, Minnesota?
It's all
across
America. It turned out it was all across America they're doing this.
No, but I mean the lawsuit where that guy was suing and they because he wasn't hired because he was too smart. Yeah, his IQ was too.
I don't remember.
Yeah,
and maybe we should change the policy in municipalities that you could have to only college students can apply for policemanship instead of high school graduates. I mean, but once again. It's the culture. It's the culture of a police department. And I, don't get me wrong, I know and meet and love a lot of police officers who are just as sick about this. You know, most police officers never even fire their gun.
Yeah, there's a lot of good cops.
There are a lot of good cops out here, and they want it to be right. I mean, any time a police officer walks out that door, they don't know what's going to happen at the course of a day. But what bothers me is this silence. When you know it's wrong, you've got to say it's wrong.
I'm with you. Joe Madison with us. We'll be back with more of your calls and Joe's thoughts, my thoughts, right after this. Hour, Joe Madison and I in the studio. Bob Ney, a former congressman, author of the brilliant book Sideswiped, about the crimes of John Boehner and many other things here in D.C., on the line with the Talk Radio News Service. Bob, we're going to do a truncated version today because I've got the good fortune of having Joe in the studio. So what are the top stories of the day?
Yes, I follow Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello. I'm really intimidated when you bring me on with Bob Ney. I'll be honest.
Bob's a good guy.
He's brilliant, too.
Bob's a good guy. So what's up, Bob?
Well, of course, you've been talking about the killing in Missouri, but I know you've been comprehensively talking about that. It's been interesting. I've been listening to it. I did want to move on to Iraq, though, because Maliki has tried to dig his heels in, and the president yesterday with his statement at Martha's Vineyard appropriately did not mention the name Maliki, as President Obama has called.
So is Maliki pulling a Saddam Hussein? Is he basically setting himself up as dictator of Iraq?
Well, nobody wants Maliki except Maliki. Even his own party, which has been reaffirmed by the court, Tom, still told him it's time to move on. You don't need a third term.
Right.
And he's trying to stay. And he went on to the television broadcast in Iraq and said to the people, reminded them that he is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of
Iraq. He appointed himself to that job, as well as interior minister and only knows what else.
Whole combination.
Yeah.
And through the Twitter process, the one of the heads of the army made it clear that they serve the Iraqi people.
Right.
They do not serve Maliki.
Okay.
But it's important, though, that they all immediately try to get a cohesive government because of ISIS and all the problems that are obviously occurring in Iraq, which comes to the point of a statement made by the Pentagon, which is the fact that the the missiles that were used and the firings that were used, which did help with the Kurds being able to move onto their defensive lines and to scatter ISIS, but they're pointing out these are really minimal impact. In other words, they want Americans to get the idea that these are able to stop ISIS on the long term. There's a bigger solution.
Right. It's gonna have to be a political solution, and it's gonna have to be the people. And so, you know, the only country in that region that went through the Arab Spring and didn't end up a mess was Tunisia. And Tunisia was the only country that we didn't help, we didn't intervene, we didn't involve ourselves, we didn't mess with. I'm telling you, Bob, George W. Bush opened the gates of hell when he decided to start bombing Afghanistan and
Iraq. You're right. We have to remember that Don Rumsfeld disarmed the entire Iraqi police and the military force.
Fired them all. He didn't disarm them. He let them go home with their guns, but he fired them all.
Arms.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
He just destroyed the entire system over there.
Yep. And Pottery Barn rules. Colin Powell is right. We broke it. We own it. Okay, Bob, thank you for the update of the news of the day.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. The Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Dale in Moriarty, New Mexico. You're on the air with Joe and I. Joe and
good
me.
Good afternoon, Tom and Joe.
Good afternoon.
I was just looking at the 2010 census report for Ferguson, Missouri, and out of a population then of 21,203, there's 6,206 white, 14,297 African Americans. But what I find very strange is that that's not the makeup. That's not the breakdown of the Ferguson police force. If there's only, did you say there was only two African American police officers?
Three,
force of 15?
And that's what someone had reported to me. Now, again, I can't go to the bank on that, but someone said there were only three African Americans on the entire police force.
Well, if that's the case, shouldn't a police force be a reflection of the demographics of the community that they're serving?
That's what we argue, yeah. But where is that the case? I mean, there's no law that says it should be. And remember now, I've lived in Dayton, Ohio, Detroit, I've lived in New York, Philadelphia. I've never lived in a city where the police department reflected the demographics of a city. I've never been in a situation like that. These jobs are passed down from the nephew, the uncle, there's a culture. Look at New York, New York City. There's no law that says it has to be. This is where political leadership comes into being, right? And this is where police work with the community. This is where you have aggressive recruiting, training. Sure, you have to consciously want to do that and then hope that there's great community policing.
Right.
You know, that's a term I haven't heard used a lot. You know, community policing.
Well, that was Bill Clinton's idea, was put 100,000 cops, get them out of their cars and put them on their shoes.
That's
get them in the neighborhoods. And George W. Bush basically rolled that program back. Said, we don't need this, which is just not a good thing. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, good morning.
not to diminish what you said about racism and the militarization of the police. I think because of the nature of the kind of men who go into that job, they would not want to do what I'm going to propose. But I think they need to have, like, a group therapy, or not necessarily therapy. But they
are you suggesting, Liz, that cops in the routine conduct of their job are exposed to so much trauma that they need to need to be treated on an ongoing basis? You know, in some environments, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, look.
Thank you, Liz.
I'm not involved in the police department, but if you work in a high crime area and you're constantly under threat, of course this is going to have impact on you psychologically. Of course it's going to have impact on people in the community. I don't know how to answer questions like that, but I don't want to get so far afield that we forget what happened to Michael Brown.
Right.
Michael Brown was one of two young men walking down the street. Doing what? Yeah. Nothing.
Walking home.
Walking to his grandmother's.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be back with Joe Madison here on the Tom Hartman program and your call right after this. Check out Joe's website, joemadison.net. And you can tweet him at Madison Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, XM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can hear him every weekday from 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM, channel 126. We'll be back with Joe Madison. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joe Madison in the studio today. You know, we started out the show an hour and a half ago, two and a half hours ago, talking about Robin Williams committing suicide and just, you know, how suicide kind of takes people away. And then Shep Smith calling him a coward and talking about the dissing of suicides, you know, as if we can stop people from committing suicide by condemning them. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I heard someone say, you know, it's sad, but it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Exactly.
You know, and people who, this is a question of mental illness. Mental illness is something we need to get very serious about in this country. And as we are finding out with Robin Williams, who transcended everything, race, you know, I don't care who you are. You loved a Robin Williams because he was such a talent. But you know what? When you walk down the streets of Washington, D.C., you see mental illness.
Yes.
You know, you see mental illness all around you. So you don't have to be a famous comedian or a movie star. We see it around us, and we need to be very, very serious about this. I don't understand how people can get on TV or wherever and call someone a coward. Who clearly suffers from mental illness.
Yeah, I had a caller call in and say, you know, cancer is a disease that often leads to death. Depression is a disease that sometimes leads to death. Why is it that we don't blame cancer victims, but we do blame depressives, people who have depression?
Yeah.
And when Reagan closed the mental hospitals in this country and cut health funding and produced an explosion of homelessness in the 1980s.
Right. Where I live here in Washington, D.C.,
we used to live a few blocks
from each other. Every morning, when I'm up early to do my show, every morning, you see it, and it's all day long. It's around us.
Yep.
And let's be honest, many of the mental institutions were hell holes.
Yep.
We just haven't found the solution yet. And I quite honestly, I think it's because the kind of attitude that you suggested somebody make a asinine statement like that about a man who clearly was brilliant but disturbed.
Well, I think it's also this Republican/libertarian notion that we can't afford to help people who are in need. It's not our responsibility as a society.
And
Darwin would be very pleased with
that. Well, you know, Darwin actually was offended by the idea of his theories being used by his cousin Herbert Spencer to promote survival of the fittest economics.
Because it should apply to animals and not human beings.
There you go. Okay, let's
I mean, I kind of like to make it simple.
Yeah, there you go. Let's take some phone calls here. Carol in Republic, Michigan. You're on the air with Joe Madison and Tom Hartman. Hey, Carol.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
And thank you for the job that both of you do. I, first of all, as a Caucasian woman, like to extend my apologies across the country to every African-American family that has to send their little child out and pray to God it comes home every day from either playing or going to school. And to the lady that used to live in L.A. and now lives in Texas, the African-American lady that is so sickened over the white people for hating black people, it, as a white person, it hurts me so deeply. I cried to hear that this little boy got shot in the street by these policemen. If you look across the country in every town, be it small or large, I would submit to you, it becomes very clear to me that we are giving criminals badges, and the psychopathic people should not be given places of power. I would just say thank you for everything you two are doing today to talk about this. My apologies go out to all black American families. Trayvon Martin, I'm still crying over that child. How do you, as a black American family, send your child out in this culture today?
Carol,
thank you, gentlemen.
Well, I have children who are of mixed race. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you answer that question. You send them out with hope. You send them out with the audacity to overcome. I used to say to my children, and I bet you once again you never had to say this to your son, you know,
or my daughters,
or your daughter, or daughters. You know, you're going to have to work twice as hard to be just as good.
Yeah,
I bet you've never had to say that.
Not to my son, but I know that my wife has said that to her daughters. Yes.
Because women are, undervalued, underestimated,
yes.
Marginalized.
Yes.
I stopped saying that. Yeah. I just said, you know what? Excuse me. No, you don't have to work twice as hard. You know what? You just do your best. And we'll make sure that we get equalization or at least equal opportunity. I stopped saying that because there's an implied inferiority in that statement.
Yeah.
It really is implied. Your circumstance and situation are so inferior. You got to run twice as fast. I stopped that. I said, no, not in 2014. No, you do not. Not when there's a black man sitting in the Oval Office. No, you do not. You don't worry. We'll make sure laws change, leadership changes. It's really about leadership. But you know, I hear this caller. She doesn't have to. It's not a question of apologizing. You have to apologize to all black Americans. Matter of fact, there's some black Americans that you know, they have to also understand they may be part of the problem. You know, I mean, you know, for example, I people who call my show, we're trying to figure out where Ben Carson's coming from.
Mm.
I mean, here's a guy who grew up poor. You know, who I'm certain depended on social programs, his mother, his brother. We know going to Yale, he depended on affirmative action. He was in the
school. So did Clarence Thomas.
And so did Skip Gates at Professor Gates at Harvard. They were all on the campus together. And now Clarence Thomas doesn't want to have anything to do with what allowed him to climb up the ladder. You know, so what do you tell your children? You tell them that, you know, we've made it better. It's a heck of a lot better than it was for my grandfather, a heck of a lot better than it was for my father, a heck of a lot better than it was for me. And by the way, I've got a daughter and a son who you can't tell them they can't do anything.
Yep.
They live, they now have a mentality. And notice around us, look how the young whites and young blacks are living in the same neighborhoods that their parents would never dream of moving into. You know, they don't have the same fears, the same apprehensions. Then that's how we've changed. And but you know, and I don't know. Again, I don't want to say every policeman is a psychopath. That's not true.
No, that's not true.
But you damn well better weed them out.
Yep.
That's what you really want to do. You want to weed them out and get them out as fast as you possibly can. Being a police officer should be a public service.
Well, this is, you know, Finland pays their police officers more than any other country in the world, and they have some of the very highest standards and lowest crime rates. Their police are they pay their teachers and their cops. Both their teachers and their cops make roughly what a doctor makes. And they hold those kind of standards for hiring, and they hold those people in that level of esteem because your teachers hold your future in their hands, and your cops hold your present in your hands.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
You know, why can't we learn that?
Yeah, the police officer's job is to protect and serve, not execute.
Right. If it took a college degree in criminal justice to get a police officer job that paid $90,000 a year plus benefits, you'd have a whole different thing. I remember when DeWitt Wanamaker got me through the Georgia Police Academy back in whatever year the Olympics came to Atlanta. I wrote a bunch of novels about a private detective. In fact, one's coming out this winter. And so I wanted to learn about I followed him around. He's an old Southern sheriff, you know, and he got me into the police academy. And I went through the Georgia Police Academy because they were doing it that year because they needed extra. They'd never taken civilians before.
Wow.
And we were sitting there in the atrium. It's got this big atrium where you can eat, and there's like this graduating troop of guys, 50 guys marching back and forth, you know, in dress formation like military. And I said, wow, that's incredible. I said, what do they pay these guys? You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to go out there and get shot at, you know. What do they pay these guys? And he says, well, I think it's around $35,000, $40,000 a year, maybe. Now, this was, you know, 15 years ago, but whatever he said, he had the right number. And I was like, you couldn't pay me that to be shot at. And he said, you know, for about 2/3 of those guys, it's tough, and they're going to do their best. But for about 1/3 of those guys, he said, you give them a stick and tell them they can beat the crap out of somebody anytime they want to, they would pay you.
Or give them a gun.
Yeah.
And tell them they can shoot somebody that they don't have any regard for.
Yeah.
But you said a word in what you were just describing. They were marching back and forth like they're in the military.
Yeah. And this is the militarization of our police, which is now on steroids all over the country.
Right.
And I think that increases the distance.
That's right.
It destroys community policing. It increases the distance between police and civilians. And they start to view civilians of all races as them.
Right.
And of minorities, it's a whole lot. There's a lot more. Yeah, absolutely. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Joe Madison with us, host of the Joe Madison Show weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on SiriusXM channel 126. You can check out his website at JoeMadison.net. We'll be right back. James in Spring City, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. You are on the air with Joe Madison and me.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm fine. Good afternoon.
Great. Really, gentlemen, let's get down to the nuts and bolts of this. I think this has to do with the paycheck, the fear of losing it, and I think this permeates all the way from the top, from the richest person, and that's the only thing we've gotten out of this trickle-down to economics, is their fear of being poor.
So you're saying the cops are killing black kids because they're afraid of being poor? I don't get it.
Well, basically, this is the way I see it. Their pay scale hasn't gone up significantly in a long time.
Right.
I see them, instead of being public servants, they're now being the buffer between the rich and the rest of society. And I see the rest of society as being sane, and the rich guy on the top, he's lost his marbles. And I see the way they control things with...
So you're suggesting that more and more police officers are the agents of enforcement of some kind of oligarchic class warfare?
Yeah, I do believe so. I believe this is the guy on the top is just afraid of being poor, and he's just, you know, just psychologically imbalanced, and he's afraid of being poor.
Yeah.
You know, we used to call it scapegoating.
Yeah.
I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, that again, people, and this goes back once again to what you remember how you started this program when we first started almost an hour and 45 minutes ago. You talked about that this problem goes all the way back to the founding of this country. And
even before that,
and quite honestly, before that, there are two sets of laws. How there are a certain set of laws and criminal laws for dark-skinned people, and as opposed to white people in this country, there always has been. There's two sets of how it's applied. There always has been, and it reminds me once again what I hear this caller saying after slavery. The end of Reconstruction was the most feared thing of white Southerners. Was Reconstruction. Why? Because it put political and economic power in the hands of former oppressed enslaved people, and white Southerners were scared as hell that they might seek revenge. And what happened? Created a compromise, the Hayes Compromise, get the federal troops out, and then all hell broke loose because folks started now, here comes the Jim Crow laws, and then local laws changed. And that was one of the first things that changed was not federal laws, it was local laws that changed, that then criminalized people by virtue of the color of their skin. Certain things you can't do. That you can't walk on this side of the street, you can't do this, you can't do that. So you made them automatic criminals.
Yeah, and then in 1898, the Supreme Court put a stamp of approval on it.
That's right, with Plessy versus Ferguson.
Said, you know, we're going to institutionalize.
We're going to institutionalize it. That's right.
Amazing. Joe Madison with us. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Joe and me. Right. Welcome back, Tom Hartman and Joe Madison with you.
They're probably wondering, what are you guys talking about?
I'm just looking at the callers here. We've got the very heart of the problem is the economic situation in the black community. If people just obey lawful orders, they wouldn't have these issues. Hatred against Obama needs to be called what it is, racism. We have a professor who used to scream for the police department. These killings are clearly racist. We need to empower the people of St. Louis to take back the city by voting. Is a whole bunch of stuff.
That was brought up today on my show. The young man I interviewed today, Gaskin was his name, very brilliant.
The ACLU guy.
Brilliant young man on our show. And he said, because I asked him, so what's next? And he said, look, here's what we really have got to do. We really have got to get these people registered and voting. They've got to be part of that. They've got to understand so that if that community votes in large numbers. Now, people go, oh, poo-poo, voting. Yeah, but then that forces that prosecutor, who may have to get elected, to sit down maybe and have monthly meetings with community leaders. It forces the mayor to then look at his chief of police and say, wait a minute, I got to get reelected in this town. I appoint you. We're not going to have this problem if my political career is at stake. And so you're absolutely, and I said, you know, that's really a great suggestion. So let's take the rioters and say instead of burning down the Quick Trip or whatever they burned down, excuse me, you're only burning down your own community. Right. You know, let's organize this energy. And can you imagine the attitude that the change of elected officials if all of a sudden?
I agree, but you know, let's not forget
what
where we're at right now. There was an organization in the United States whose principal charter was registering mostly minorities. Mostly black people, but poor people specifically was their charter. But it was ACORN. And look at what happened to them. James O'Keefe came along. You got this organized right-wing conspiracy, and they got taken down.
Well, let me tell you, I worked with ACORN. I was the political director of the NAACP. When ACORN, we worked closely with ACORN and other organizations to do voter registration. One of the things I introduced was something that's now being thrown out in North Carolina. To give high school students upon graduation the opportunity to register to vote so that at the time that they get their diploma, they also are on the books to be registered voters. So if they're 17, they would, in essence, freeze their registration, and it would be automatic. We had state after state that implemented that. It was great. Kids loved it. They felt empowered politically. And now look what North Carolina is doing. They just threw it out.
Right.
Why?
Well, because young people tend to vote Democratic rather than Republican, and they've got a Republican administration.
I mean, what I'm saying is, then, you know, instead of throwing it out, then Republicans go to work on trying to convince young people to support your position.
Well, they are doing that. They're funding professors in colleges
and
all kinds of stuff. But
donating money to the United Negro College Fund by the millions of dollars. I mean, come on, I don't mind fair play. You know, that's fine. Yeah. But don't, you know, we didn't register these young people as Democrats. We registered them as citizens.
Voters. There you go. Mike in Munster in Indiana. Hey, Mike, you're on the air with Joe and me.
Yeah, thank you. It seems to me the problem kind of boils down to an economic problem. We've got a lot of racism in America. If you see a black man with a hoodie, you know, you cross the street. And it seems we got to uplift the inner city, black or white, poor, you know, just the poor areas, get them developed and maybe rethink our welfare system so you can rid the crime in the area and it can, you know, develop and, you know, so forth. We might not, you know, alleviate some of the stereotype about, you know, black people and crime and so forth.
To a certain extent, Joe, isn't there some truth to the idea that 32 years of Reaganomics has so devastated the middle class that it's a lot easier for Fox News and right-wing talk show hosts to go out and basically pit Americans against each other based on the color of their skin?
And the fairness doctrine, I always refer to that, too, because that was under the Reagan, doctrine. The fairness doctrine,
yeah.
You know, when
87.
Was it 87?
Yeah, that's when Reagan started.
Because I remember, look how we listen to radio now.
Yeah.
If the fairness doctrine was in place right now, Fox would be out of business.
Yeah.
Or else they would have to change their business model.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great to see Sean Hannity having to sit with a conservative and a Republican at the same time?
Or a liberal, you mean?
A liberal, yeah, and a conservative at, yeah, the same time. And, oh, and by the way, be fair in your question. You know,
good
your
luck
question
on that.
Yeah, but that was part of the game plan, because this is, look, this is your, but your economic point is well made. So when the president says, look, you can't move your headquarters address to a foreign country to avoid paying taxes that help to do what? Build schools.
Right.
I'll say this and I'll say it again. Education's the new currency of the 21st century.
Yeah.
Education's the new currency. It's not gold, it's not yens, it's not marks, it's going to be education. And we in this country must invest in education. Education is the
key.
And
instead we're doing the exact opposite.
We got
$1.2 trillion dollars in student debt.
Thank you. We must do what India did, what Japan has done, what China is doing, what Germany, all of Europe is doing. And if we do not invest heavily in education, then we're going to be in a sorry state of where you will have two, and you write this better than I can speak it, there will be no middle class. It'll just be the super rich and the very poor.
And the serfs. Yeah, it takes us back to the world that Charles Dickens wrote about. You know, in A Christmas Carol.
That's right.
Bob Cratchit. He was
was
the 96% of the population.
That's the moral of that story.
And Scrooge wasn't the rich, by the way. He was the middle class.
Right.
He was a small business owner who had one employee.
Right.
And it's like people don't get that either. Because the real rich, I mean, they weren't even in the story. Dickens' dad, you know, he was in a debtor's prison.
Right.
He knew that. Anyhow, Joe Madison, check him out on SiriusXM channel 126. JoeMadison.net, the website. Joe, it's always an honor and pleasure to have you with me.
Are we through? Fastest 2 hours I've ever spent.
We had a good time.
Thank you very much.
Great
and
to
thank
see
your audience and thank the callers.
Yeah, and my apologies to everybody we didn't get to. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.